My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagrids, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast way sooner than, we usually are, because it's only been, 23 hours since we published episode 102. But the circumstances, which I also explained in that episode with a quick post-edit, forced us to record another episode this week. So congratulations to all of our listeners. You're getting extra Western Bubble content, because today we're talking about Zelensky fighting with Donald Trump and J.D. Vance in the Oval Office, and the whole world losing its mind. Balder, why are we speaking about this topic today?
Oh yeah, and why are we speaking about it today? Highly unusual on a Wednesday evening. Normally we don't record at this hour and in the middle of the week. And exactly because we just, in the previous episode that you refer to, we just said we have to get away from Trump derangement syndrome. We have to stop talking about Trump all the time and only focus on the things that really matter. Well, this actually really matters, not just because of the unpleasantness that happened in the Oval Office, not just the kind of bullying setup which turned Zelensky into a victim of Trump and Vance being basically nasty, but also because of the very real serious consequences that are attached to that. There are some things coming out of that moment, out of Trump setting up Zelensky, that have a significant impact on the way that Europe and the rest of the world are going to go forward.
Maybe some listeners have been living under a rock and they're only listening to our podcast. So let's quickly remind them what happened. It happened last week, all right, where I remember I first saw it on social media, just a quick clip from the Oval Office, and I thought, do I need to look at this clip from the Oval Office? I mean, what is Trump going to say that I can't, like, that I didn't expect already? But then I saw the comments, and the comments were really excited, but not in a positive way, and concerned. And then I looked at the video and I saw Trump sitting there, next to him Zelensky, and then there was a little kid on a sofa. There was J.D. Vance, right? A little really annoying boy that everyone disliked in high school, I feel like. These are some personal opinions I'm expressing here. Basically the scene was, as you said, two bullies taking on the little child, or country in this sense, and just ambushing him into an open confrontation in order to humiliate him, right? It was from the get-go, you see Trump and Vance cornering Zelensky verbally and just lashing onto him and basically calling him out.
Yeah, so if you look at the broader press conference, this was such a clear setup. It already started with questions from the media, which had been relatively carefully selected, right? Ironically, TASS was there, the Russian news agency, whereas AP and others had been banned. They have been banned for a while from the White House because they're too critical of Trump. There was a question immediately from reporter to Zelensky, why don't you wear a suit, right? Which became a theme that then Vance and Trump jumped onto. It was completely obvious that this was set up with Vance there, which is also unusual, because usually you would have just the two presidents, or if you have a vice president, you make sure that there are two vice presidents to have some kind of balance. This was two people who were bound to go after Zelensky, who had planned to make him look small and weak, probably with two or three objectives in mind. First objective, show the American public that the United States protects its own interests, and that Trump is this strong, powerful leader who doesn't mind going after someone like Zelensky. Second objective, to signal to Russia that Trump is at a very minimum neutral, is not a friend of Zelensky, and doesn't mind being tough as a negotiator on Zelensky. And three, to bully Zelensky into accepting some kind of deal when it comes to the minerals, and letting Zelensky know that either he accepts what the United States demands of him, or there are going to be consequences, right? It was a power play of the worst kind against a president and a country that for the past 3 years has been clinging on by a threat, right? They have been invaded by an enormously powerful country and are just trying to survive. Ukraine is literally trying to survive. And anyone who saw that should feel some kind of deep unease, because this is what bullying looks like. Power asymmetry leading to abuse. It was horrifying to watch.
I was about to say, I felt secondhand embarrassment for both sides, right? So on the one hand, for Zelensky, for being humiliated in front of the whole world. And on the other side, also for the Trump and Vance, because come on, it's such obviously rude behavior, right? As to choose my words carefully here. I was really embarrassed for them and also for the United States.
It is incredibly embarrassing, and it not just rude, but also childish, right? When we think of bullies, we typically think of a 13-year-old teenager that is sort of dealing with some personal angst and projecting that onto relatively easy targets. And that's exactly what it felt like. It was at such a low level, something that wouldn't be accepted in most social circumstances, let alone in the White House when presidents are talking to each other. It was pathetic and it was unpleasant to watch. Now, you could also see that Zelensky was not prepared for this. He was improvising with his answers, not making things better, because obviously he did not expect that. That was completely obvious. There was also this shot of the Ukrainian ambassador kind of being completely like, oh no, what's going on? This was bad. One thing that annoyed me about social media, for example, on LinkedIn, but also elsewhere, there were supposed experts explaining how this was a clash of negotiating tactics and culture. And whenever I read that, I wanted to shout at the author, this was a press conference. This was a negotiations, right? These press conferences, where the whole press is pointing at two presidents, exist for the two presidents to shake hands, to be nice to each other, and to show that they're civil towards each other. Negotiations happen behind closed doors. And we know that sometimes in negotiations, tensions rise high and things go horribly wrong, and there might be shouting, and there might be, but that is behind closed doors. This was a press conference. This was not a place to negotiate. And anyone who tries to explain this, and LinkedIn has a lot of these lunatics that try to explain these dynamics in terms of business acumen and different expectations, don't understand what they were watching. This was supposed to be a civil press conference between two sitting presidents.
I want to add a small detail to what you said about the quote-unquote journalist that asked one of the first questions, because this point of Republicans, US Republicans, being very upset with Zelensky for not wearing a suit, right, for always wearing his kind of his war outfit. That has been well known that this is kind of frustrating to them. The guy who asked the question is called Brian Glenn, a quote-unquote journalist from the right-wing channel Real America's Voice. And according to The Atlantic, he's reportedly dating the House of Representatives person Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? That really crazy blonde lady who is the I don't think conspiracy theorists would do her justice, right? Who's just a crazy lady. So, I mean, he was clearly chosen with an agenda and an objective and told, hey, ask the first question, ask exactly this question, and set off the tone for all of this.
This was a coordinated ambush. It's completely obvious that's what they planned to do. And they were desperately looking for ways to escalate the moment, right? So when Zelensky said something along the lines of, the United States has to be careful, that was great for Trump because Trump could jump on it and say, don't tell us what we have to be careful of. Know where you are. Know how to respect us. Now, we can also talk about Vance going on and on about, did you actually say thank you? Right? That is, of course, insanity. Ukraine and Zelensky personally have multiple times thanked the United States for their support, not just under Biden, but also under Trump. Trump won the first presidency and now. Even at the start of the press conference, Zelensky said that. So it's basically manufactured outrage that was planned ahead and that has nothing to do with anything real. Now, the The focus on the clothes is also interesting for two reasons. I myself, in when I lecture, have sometimes pointed out that the whole wearing of a t-shirt and all that and not wearing a suit is marketing by Zelensky. I mean, he explains it like out of respect for the soldiers, but there's nothing in itself that requires him to wear that t-shirt. He just wants to show the world that he is fighting a war and that his people are fighting a war. I've never been a big fan of it, but it is what it is. To make that a big deal in this press conference is obviously a tactic by Trump. It's not that they actually felt offended because, hang on, who also doesn't wear a proper suit? Someone like Elon Musk. Nobody criticizes him, right? When he and his child go into the Oval Office and kind of break every tradition that the United States has had over the past 250 years. So that focus on the suit is very much, once again, a power play. Oh, you little man, we can make fun of your dress sense. We can make fun of your clothes because we are the ones in charge here. It's exactly what bullies would do.
Well, let's move away from kind of focusing on the Trump derangement syndrome, right? Because we did say that we want to focus on kind of the more important and the matters here, the bigger picture. What does this mean for the world? And I think before we talk about the world as a whole or the Western world, I think this is really bad news for Ukraine, isn't it? If your biggest supporter when it comes to military aid is suddenly saying, right, we are no longer supporting you.
But this was clear from the day that Trump won the elections. At a foreign policy level, I actually don't think that it's necessarily overall bad for the world that Trump won. That is an ambiguous kind of area, because at least what Trump doesn't have is this Western bubble thinking about the United States being the city on the hill that the rest of the world has to follow. Trump doesn't believe in exceptionalism. He doesn't believe that the United States is different from any other country. He just believes that the United States needs to take care of its own business. And that might actually be relatively good, broadly speaking, because it clarifies how the rest of the world should position itself. But the moment he got elected, we knew it would be bad news for Ukraine, and we knew it would be bad news for the Palestinians. And that's exactly what we've been seeing. Ukraine is a victim of the Trump election because it means that now the Ukraine has lost its most important strategic partner. And not just that, more so than I would have expected, Trump has gone full Moscow, has gone full Putin in his approach. If you're Ukrainian, that's bad news. I would argue it's terrible news if you're a US citizen. Americans should be kind of panicking about where their country is going, because they're losing this leadership position that has taken them this far over the past 250 years. It's very rapidly in declining. It's obvious. Losers out of all of this, the United States itself. It's bad for the US. It's terrible for Ukraine. For the rest of the world, it depends on how they react to this.
One thing that confused me a little bit was the reaction by some European leaders. Because on the one hand, they were the ones who said, oh, we immediately need to call for a summit, a European summit, and all of us need to come together. We need to discuss a post-United States hegemony world. And then some others said, well, you know, the Donald, that's what he does. Let's give him a little bit of what he wants and maybe we will remain on his good side.
There's a real latent, if you like, legacy among European leaders when it comes to the United States. So people my age and older, which are typically now the leaders in charge, right? The people in their late 40s, 50s, 60s, they are the ones who still grew up in a Cold War. They, you know, I as a child remember the Cold War. I was young, but I very much remember what the Cold War felt like. And the almost automatic, natural alliance with the United States. And in some regard, these leaders still feel that. And they can't escape this idea that the United States will always be there for them, because that's how we grew up as children. And so it is very difficult to rationally assess the United States if that is your deeply seated psyche, if that is your foundational perspective on global relations. So it's not just dismissing the idea that, oh, you know, Trump is there for four years and then, you know, he's going to be a bit weird, but things will be fine afterwards. That's kind of, by the way, that was the reality in the first presidency of Trump, because then he was still constrained by institutions. He couldn't do much. Now those institutions seem to be either weakened or gone. I mean, I am still amazed by how quickly the United States is bending over to Trump's will. Where is the opposition? Where are the Democrats? Where is everyone else? And these European leaders say, okay, you know what? We're still in that mindset of, okay, Trump is going to be Trump and then things will go back to normal. But Trump is a symptom of something that has been developing over the past 25 years. The transatlantic alliance has been dying and Trump is just accelerating it. He's clarifying it. He's making reality clearer. And it means that the right reaction would be to say, look, we are happy to do business with the United States. We are happy to work with them, but we've got to now make sure that we can operate independently if necessary, that we don't need the United States if they choose not to support us, because that is a very real scenario. Look at what just happened to Ukraine. And that is something that those leaders cannot grasp still. It seems as if they are still in this kind of Stockholm syndrome of whatever the United States does, in the end, they love us. They can abuse us, they can be abusive to Ukraine, they can be abusive to others, but in the end, it is still a deep relationship that will always last. And that is a huge, huge strategic mistake.
I saw a segment on British television about exactly this, I think just today or maybe yesterday, where there were four commentators discussing how Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of the UK, is responding to all of this. And because J.D. Vance kind of insulted the British military. I don't know if you saw this, right? Of when he said, oh,
a random nation
that hasn't fought a war in 20 years now wants to create a peacekeeping group of sorts. And the commentators were really struggling with kind of letting go of that special relationship that the UK claims to have with the United States. So two of them were saying, oh no, you know, Starmer needs to really salvage that special relationship with the United States because we have that special relationship with the United States. And the two others were saying that, yeah, we used to, but I'm really angry at him now and I want to end the special relationship.
Yeah, that special relationship thing has been always a bit of nonsense in the sense that the real special relationship that UK has with our country is with Europe, of course, because of history, because of close ties, because of proximity. It has always been something more in the British mind than in the American mind, and the United States has been able to exploit this. So now, for example, the Trump administration is floating the idea of exempting the UK from tariffs. That is not out of a specific love for the United Kingdom. It is a way to create a split among European allies, right? Like, hey, UK, stay with us and we will be friends, but we want you to move away from Europe even further than Brexit has already moved you away. So it is a strategic option available to the United States. But believe me, American foreign policymakers feel no specific love for the UK compared to any other country, certainly not under Trump. It is just something in the mind of the UK. And they need to get rid of this thought process, this kind of foundational assumption.
Here, one leader that surprised me, because it's someone that I think we have criticized also a lot here on the podcast, is Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Right, who it seemed like he was basically almost being kicked out of office tomorrow, but he has made the comeback of the year thanks to Trump and his tariffs on Canada, and is now starting to receive some support at home again. And I was actually very surprised, positively surprised, by his speech, not to Trump, but to the American population, saying that, hey, Americans, we have this special friendship, we are neighbors. And these policies or these tariffs are not going against you as the population. We still love you as our friends and so on and so forth. But this is going against your government that has gone rogue a little bit. I was actually surprised by that because he kind of shows that he's standing up to the bully. He's sending back those same tariffs to the United States, actually in a more sensible way, right? Where he first put the tariffs on, I think only 30 billion of the goods that are affected by this. And the other ones only, I think 21 days later. So that the industry, right, that the companies actually have some time to get used to it and prepare for this. So he really gave a, for this situation for which there's no playbook, by the way, to me, he gave a very sensible reaction.
Yeah, it's not clear to me how much of it is actually conviction of how much of it is just political convenience. Because like you said, this stance has allowed him to come back into politics, whereas he seemed to be done, basically, way behind in the opinion polls. But the conservatives are now seen to be too close to the Trump administration, have in the past been supportive of Trump, and Trudeau now has an opportunity to actually present himself as the savior of Canadian sovereignty and Canadian independence. So I have no psychological analysis of Trudeau. I don't know him in any way, shape or form. But I wonder how much of it is actually that he believes that this is the right thing to do, and how much of it is simply out of political convenience. Having said that, I think European leaders could actually learn from this, because regardless of what the reason is, this is exactly what you need to do in this stage for two reasons. For the reason that the alliance with the United States is no longer automatic and can no longer be relied upon unconditionally. We know that literally Trump and the United States will put conditions in place in order to support or secure their allies. This is a departure from 80 years of the United States basically saying we will be there for you no matter what. And secondly, because you need to have certain basic principles in order to stay true to who you are, even if that is costly. You cannot give in to this kind of bullying. When you see what happened to Zelensky, you need to take a stance, because otherwise you lose your own identity. And this is what goes horribly wrong, for example, with my former prime minister and now secretary general of NATO, Mark Rutte, who seems to have completely forgotten this, that yes, there is a practical expediency in trying to keep things together, but at some point you need to stick to certain principles.
Is there a European leader you could imagine would do well in a one-on-one with Trump right now? I mean, Macron didn't do too bad a few days before. But apart from that, I'm not sure I'm not sure if any leader would have reacted well to this bullying situation, right? Being caught this off guard in the situation that Zelensky was in.
No. I mean, if you didn't expect this, then it is extremely hard or almost impossible to deal with this, right? So if you didn't see this coming, the only thing that you could do in a situation like that is probably at some point cut the press conference short. Basically say, hey, look, this is not what I came here to do. I'm sorry, I'm out. If you do that, then you must make sure that your country is in a position to face the consequences. And of course, Zelensky couldn't face the consequences, but someone like Macron or someone like Starmer, if they had been put in that position, they probably would have had that option, right? An option that Zelensky didn't have. Now, I'm sure that afterwards, or with some preparation in advance, there are all kinds of really good comebacks that Zelensky could have had. For example, Zelensky could have emphasized the fact that hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers have either died or been injured by this violence, and that he would very much appreciate it if Trump respected their sacrifice, right? Appeal to the emotional side of the fact that here's a country fighting for its existence. And Trump would have had difficulty responding to that, because the American audience, the American public, would not appreciate disrespecting fallen soldiers, right? But that is all only with either preparation or afterwards in hindsight that you could come up with that. The fact is that this situation was very difficult, would have been very difficult for any leader. But going back to my Prime Minister Rutte, he had 24 hours to think about how to respond to this, right? And he didn't actually respond in any reasonable way. He said something along the lines, and I'm reading it out here. He said, I told Zelensky that you have to find a way, dear Vladimir, to restore your relationship with Donald Trump and the American administration. That is important going forward. We really have to respect what President Trump has done so far for Ukraine. Now, that quote, end of quote, that quote saying that you need to respect Donald Trump for what he has done and you have to fix the relationship is basically Rutte saying, well, suck it up, Zelensky, you're being bullied, accept being the victim of bullying, and I'm okay with that. Now, someone could argue that Rutte does that from his perspective as NATO's Secretary General. You know, you, as Secretary General, you need to keep it together. And NATO without the United States will no longer exist. Without the United States, there is no NATO. And he is desperate to keep it together. Fine, but this goes back to my whole point, that you have to also stick to certain basic principles of what is decent and what isn't decent. And the moment that Rutte says this to Zelensky, says to the world, hey, you know, it's up to you to fix this, despite Trump being the bully, is basically forgoing any kind of basic decency. And that is going to come back to bite you at some point.
Well, speaking of what is decent and not decent, let's talk about Friedrich Merz, the soon-to-be chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany. As the listeners know, I'm sitting here in Berlin. I'm working in politics here in Berlin. So unfortunately, I have to look at what he's doing all day long. And Friedrich Merz is a very interesting case study when it comes to all of this, right? Because he was basically elected chancellor only 10 days ago, right? And he ran on a platform of we can no longer, like, we, right, Germany has this thing in its constitution that's called a debt brake, meaning German cannot go, go into debt for its budget. Right, it's a rule that there's controversy about. But he campaigned on it, making sure that, you know, the debt brake will stay. Now, fast forward a week. And to the situation between Donald Trump and Zelensky, and basically Ukraine standing there without the support of the United States. And I think within Europe, it became clear that now Europe has to fill that gap, or has to at least attempt to fill that gap, and also has to realize that the European Union can no longer rely on the United States for its security, particularly for its nuclear umbrella.
Sorry to interrupt, Dario, but it is important to point out that this is a there are two sides to this argument in Europe right now, right? It's like the Rutte side that argues that Europe has to basically fulfill the wishes of Trump to keep it all together. And then there's the other side of we actually now need to move away from Trump and invest in our own infrastructure. And I think that second side is the appropriate response to this.
Well, it is the appropriate response. And that's the side that Friedrich Merz tends to. So, and he's currently in coalition talks, right, with the Social Democrats. And he basically did a full 180 degree turn. Well, some could even say 450, right? He just kept on turning. Because he went away from his obsession with not going into debt and basically saying, okay, you know what, we need to go into a lot of debt right now because we need to build up our own military, build up our own military and make sure that we no longer rely on the United States for Europe's security. He's also pairing this with investments into general infrastructure, right? And we're talking about a total package of somewhat over 900 billion euros, right? Which is not a little sum of money. However, in order to get this money, Germany needs to change its constitution, right? Because as I said earlier, that this debt brake is enshrined within the constitution. And I was actually personally quite happy that they decided to invest into infrastructure amongst some other things. And I thought, okay, great, this is a good time, right? In times of crisis, you're supposed to invest to make sure that your country and your economy gets through the crisis rather well, is at least what they taught me in university. And I was very much looking forward to having a new coalition government, right? The new parliament will step together for the first time on the 25th or 26th of March. And then we can talk about this, right? You do need a two-thirds majority to change the constitution. And this is where Friedrich Merz comes in, and a little caveat, because with the new composition of parliament, the parties in the center no longer have a two-thirds majority, right? Because the far right and the far left, they both have, if you put them together, they have about a third, so they could block any attempt to change the constitution. And what does this lead to, right? Is that now Friedrich Merz and Social Democrats and the Green Party, they want to vote on this a 1 week before the new parliament steps together, right? So after the elections, the population has expressed its will and desire for the next 4 years. But right before, they basically still with the old majority that they have, right? That old two-thirds majority, if you count all of them together, they quickly want to change the constitution. And it seems like here in Germany, everyone is happy about the debt brake going away, but no one is looking at the fact that we are completely slapping democracy in the face.
Yeah, this is exactly, once again, an example of the breaking down of institutions that then gets abused by populist leaders afterwards, right? So democracy is is contingent on elections, but elections are way less important than respecting those basic unspoken rules, unwritten rules about respecting process, about respecting procedure, about respecting, broadly speaking, the will of the people. And that is not something that you can specifically legislate. That has to be something that everyone has inside of them and knows not to break. Most of democracy is based on unspoken and unwritten rules. And the moment that you do something like this, the moment that you try to desperately push through a measure, even though you know that the people have just elected a new type of government, a new parliamentary power division, that is undermining your own democracy, it's undermining your own society, and in the long term, it only will, you know, hurt you. It will make it easier for populist leaders, in this case the AfD, for example, to say, look, they're desperately trying to undermine the will of the Germans. Vote for us next time because we will respect you. We know that you're fed up with the establishment that is just trying to have its cake and eat it. And so it is always extremely sad to see this. By the way, I say this as someone who, just like you, agrees with the basic idea, agrees with the actual plan, but it has to be within proper process. And if you don't do that, you are actually responsible for the decline of, you know, long-term health of German democracy and liberalism.
Right. And that's something that no one is willing to understand, at least in the conversations I've had in the past few days with people who work in politics here in Berlin. What concerns me is that if this had been an emergency law that you need to pass, right? Because otherwise, I don't know, the government stops functioning or there's something really important. And it's just a law that requires a simple 50% majority. I think that's something that I could give them a quick pass for.
Yeah, like a natural disaster, earthquake or nuclear disaster or something like that.
Disaster relief, exactly. But we're talking about the changing of the constitution. And we're talking about investments for the next 5 to 10 years. We're talking about something that's actually about shaping the country. And I mean, the main reason why they don't want to do it is because, right, no one is going to vote with the Alternative for Germany in German parliament, not after what happened a few weeks ago when that happened once between the conservatives and them, right? And that was already a bit very concerning to me about the personal qualifications of Friedrich Merz as the next chancellor. So no one is going to vote with the far right, mostly for historical reasons, right? And because there's some truly dodgy people in there. The people on the far left, there is some dodgy individuals, but in general, all they are is really far left. And right, the reason why they might not be able to pass this constitutional change to increase spending for the military is because the far left is against increasing spending for the military. But there could have been some deal, right? To maybe, okay, you know what? We'll get rid of the debt break. You can spend more on the military, but you can also spend more on social stuff. But, right, and that's a compromise that happens in democracy all the time, right? And then your side doesn't win all the way. Oh, no. But the fact that for a quick win for your side, you're willing to a week before the new parliament comes together and after the population has already voted on this, the fact that you are willing to undermine this shows me that you are the problem that we've been talking about in this Western Bubble podcast all the time, that you are the one, that middle manager, Friedrich Merz, who is undermining and hollowing out institutions and are setting the scene for Trump.
Yeah, and it's missing the bigger picture. It is missing a certain sensitivity about what makes democracy democratic, what makes liberalism liberal. It's something that has been the consistent story of the 21st century. You could go all the way back to the War on Terror, where rules were already broken, unspoken traditions that are required for a healthy democracy were already violated. And in many ways, 2025 is a result of that process of the past 24 years. Since 9/11, and you have now a generation of people, exactly as you called them, that are managers, that have basically no respect for that. They seem to think that all you need for democracy is to have elections that aren't manipulated too much. And as long as you've got those elections, then democracy is fine. No, democracy and liberalism depend on these basic unspoken foundations. There's an interesting parallel here, by the way, between what you just described happened in Germany and what Trump did in the White House, right? In the Oval Office with Zelensky. Because there's also an unwritten rule in diplomacy that you don't do this to a foreign head of state that comes to visit you. And the moment that you do this, you break something that is going to be very hard to repair, right? Breaking those unspoken rules means that for a very long time, you're going to have a hard time going back to the old way of doing things. So everyone who now visits the White House will be extremely careful in what the press conference is going to be like, is going to demand all kinds of guarantees that they won't be set up, with all the consequences that entails. Just like it's going to be very hard for the German government to recover the damage that has been done with these kinds of undemocratic steps. We are now living in a world where slowly everything is basically collapsing in front of us, and that is because of the lack of foundational principles. It is the lack of people understanding that you need to have certain red lines that you don't cross, even if it's practically or politically convenient. So if you're Rutte, I understand that you want to save NATO, but you still have to have certain principles that are higher than NATO, that are higher than your job. If you're Merz, I understand that you want to pass this bill, but you still have to have certain principles that where you understand that you're representative of German democracy that is better than your that is bigger than your direct political agenda. And of course, if you're Trump, but this is wishful thinking, you are president of the United States. Of course, there are certain things that you want to achieve at a personal level, at a political level. But as president of the United States, you also have to show respect to foreign dignitaries. You have to respect to foreign heads of state.
This seems like a depressing enough moment to end today's conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today for this special extra episode, right? Breaking news Wednesday night. We're doing everything for you. Please make sure to join us again in a few days when the actual next episode is coming out on Wednesday, and we'll burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I thought it would be appropriate to talk about power imbalance and bullying at the end of this episode, because that's exactly what we've been witnessing. And I took a quote by author Isabel Allende, who wrote, "What I fear most is power with impunity. I fear abuse of power and the power to abuse."